Last week, we were talking to the journalist Franklin Foer about his latest book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech.
My argument is against the big technology companies, which really are racing to expand into every nook and cranny of our lives.
We spoke with Foer a year ago. His book was partially funded by a center-left think tank called the New America Foundation.
That's since become relevant just because they fired a vociferous critic of Google from the foundation, which is noteworthy because the foundation has received a fair amount of money from Google chairman Eric Schmidt.
Right. So how much fun is it for you to be publishing a new book and already distancing yourself from the foundation that funded the writing of it?
It actually doesn't feel good because New America has been supportive of me over time, and I'd rather not seem like a jerk and disavow them when they've been so nice to me. But this does feel like sadly reflective of a much bigger issue.
Who was the critic who was fired?
His name is Barry Lynn, and he ran something called the Open Markets Program there. A very active opponent of monopoly and a very vociferous critic of Google.
We used to have an affiliation with the New America Foundation, but we were kicked out of New America.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, we tell the rest of that messy story.
At no point did Google or any funder tell me to fire Barry Lynn.
And we look at how corporations use philanthropy to shape the public debate and how that can go terribly wrong.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Barry Lynn started out as a journalist.
I worked in Venezuela and in Peru as a foreign correspondent. And then after that, I ran a magazine called Global Business Magazine.
We should say it was a pro-business magazine.
We were a magazine that aimed at the people who ran businesses. So we had a real inside look at how globalization actually works at the institutional level.
That inside look led to Lynn crossing over to the other side. He came to believe that corporations are too powerful and that their power is too concentrated. This was a theme he pursued in a couple of books and, since 2002, with the New America Foundation. His project came to be known as the Open Markets Institute.
We got the work going, and we did it with increasing effect over the last 7 years, to the point where in 2016, we had a number of folks on the Hill starting to understand that, indeed, America has a monopoly problem. And the first person who sort of really reached out and said, I want to actually sort of help shine a light on this problem was Senator Warren. And the result was a speech that she gave on Capitol Hill.
Senator Elizabeth Warren's speech was part of a conference organized by the Open Markets Institute. It was called America's Monopoly Problem.
Today in America, competition is dying.
This was probably the most important speech about concentration in the United States, about the monopoly problem, since a series of speeches that FDR gave in the 1930s.
Google, Apple, and Amazon provide platforms that lots of companies depend on for survival. But Google, Apple, and Amazon also, in many cases, compete with those small companies. So that platform can become a tool to snuff out competition.
And she said, you know, it's not just an issue that affects us as consumers, it also affects our democracy because it's this concentration of power that leads to concentrations of wealth. And concentrations of wealth lead to concentrations of control over government and other institutions of authority.
This line of criticism would seem to be pretty much in sync with the mission of not only the Open Markets Institute, but also its parent organization, the New America Foundation.
In my own scholarship, I've written about monopolies and risks of consolidation and data ownership.
That's Anne-Marie Slaughter, the former State Department official and Princeton professor, who's now president and CEO of New America.
What convinced me to leave Princeton and become head of New America, which was a big move because I had a wonderful position at Princeton, was this idea that we really could be a place that hosted fundamental debates about our future in the digital age.
But as Barry Lynn tells the story, New America didn't share his enthusiasm for the conference he put together where Senator Warren spoke.
Well, a few people in my organization at New America were not happy with the way we were framing the conference and the fact that we were focusing some of our attention on the platform monopolies and especially on Google.
What was wrong with focusing on Google in a conference about monopoly? After all, they do own some 90% of the global search market.
Or I guess the question is, why is our work at New America problematic for Google? Google, Eric Schmidt, who is now the chair of the board at Google, was also for a long time on the New America board and then for a period of time served as the chair of our board.
Eric Schmidt was the chairman of Google and its renamed parent company, Alphabet, for several years. He stepped down in early 2018 after our interview with Barry Lynn. For years, Schmidt was also CEO of Google. He has also given New America a lot of money, both personally and through his family foundation. So did Google itself. Between Schmidt and Google, New America had received roughly $20 million since its founding in 1999.
So there was a relationship between our two organizations. And this is a relationship that goes back to the very early days at New America and actually had never seemed to result in any kind of problems at New America up to this point.
But now it seemed there was a problem. Were Schmidt and or Google leaning on New America as Lynn's critique of the company grew more intense? A year after the New America conference, where Senator Warren spoke against Google's domination, European antitrust regulators hit Google with a huge fine, $2.7 billion, for allegedly tilting search results in its own favor. Not long after that, in June of 2017, Barry Lynn posted a statement on the New America website. It congratulated European regulators for giving Google such a good spanking and urged American regulators to do the same.
Yeah, we released this statement in support of the decision in Europe. And that was on June 27th. And on June 29th, I was told that my entire team had to leave. And we had 2 months to leave.
One natural conclusion to draw was that Google had stepped in and asked New America to do something about Barry Lynn. Indeed, that's how it was portrayed in the New York Times. Their headline read, "Google critic ousted from think tank funded by the tech giant."
And at that point, I, you know, asked for this decision to be reconsidered. And if it could not be reconsidered, I asked for more time. And I was told that neither of those was possible.
The writer Franklin Foer, who happens to sit on the board of Barry Lynn's Open Markets Institute, told us a similar version of events. He made it clear that Lynn's statement about the European regulator's decision...
This was something that was a bit too far for Google. And New America was very generous in supporting me, and they never did anything to interfere with my own work. But I was fairly outraged by their treatment of Barry. And I can't resign from New America because I'm not affiliated with them. I'm not taking any money from them now. But I'm extremely disappointed.
But Anne-Marie Slaughter offered a substantially different portrayal. First of all, she says,
no funder at New America has ever influenced New America content in any way.
And this.
Well, New America has a set of principles on our website that makes very clear that no funding can affect the integrity of our research and or shape the research in any way. We do not pay to play. We take funding and we do our work, and those two things are separate.
But the timing of Lynn's firing certainly gave the appearance that Google and or Eric Schmidt had asked Slaughter and or the New America Foundation to get rid of Barry Lynn and his Open Markets Institute. And Slaughter found herself on the defensive.
At no point did Google or any funder tell me to fire Barry Lynn. And at no point did Google or any funder try to influence the work of anybody here. And if any funder ever did tell me that, I'd tell them to take a hike.
That is Anne-Marie Slaughter at a New America event last year called Is Big Tech an Existential Threat? The event was actually in support of Franklin Foer's book.
I did not part ways with Barry Lynn for anything to do with Google. So I decided that Barry Lynn and I had to part ways because he could not work respectfully, honestly, and cooperatively with his colleagues.
So Slaughter says she got rid of Lynn not because of a funding conflict of interest, but because he was a difficult employee.
I don't actually think this is just a think tank issue. I worked at major universities, three universities, and universities have private funders for centers and for different bodies of research. And, you know, I think even newspapers have constant tensions between advertisers and reporters that reporters don't have to navigate, but the management does. I think there is a general tension wherever you need to protect the integrity of research, and you also need to fund that research.
New America says all its major funders are listed on its website. We asked Slaughter for a breakdown.
Only 12% comes from corporations. The rest comes from foundations. By far the largest amount comes from foundations and then from private individuals.
Taking corporate money does not mean necessarily that the work of the entire institution is suspect.
Barry Lynn again.
But it definitely can create a slippery slope that will lead to pressures being brought to bear on those people who are questioning concentrations of power or the use of corporate power in other ways.
I think people are right to have a kind of skeptical, maybe cynical orientation to what let's call corporate lobbying or corporate philanthropy.
And that's Robert Reich, a political scientist at Stanford. He's written a new book called Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better.
My research interests these days focus a great deal on philanthropy and the role philanthropy plays in democratic societies.
And that philanthropy increasingly comes in the form of foundations.
There are lots of foundations.
What is the median size of assets? It's really small, right? $1 million or so?
Oh, yeah, it's not much. Maybe a couple $1 million. But there's an enormous growth in the number of foundations. And that's just a kind of logical consequence of growing inequality in the United States.
Just talk about your thesis, essentially, the role, the influence, and the complications around modern philanthropies.
I'd start by saying most people's attitude about philanthropists and about foundations is that we should be grateful that people are trying to do good with their own money. And that's the attitude I want to try to sweep away. I don't think philanthropists deserve that amount of charity, if you will. Why is that? Because philanthropy, especially large philanthropy in the form of a foundation or especially wealthy person, represents the exercise of power in which they attempt to use their own private wealth to affect public outcomes or to produce public benefits or make social change. And power deserves scrutiny in a democratic society, not gratitude. I'd add on top of that that a foundation in particular, which is a legal form that allows a wealthy person to create a donor-directed, unaccountable, barely transparent, perpetual and tax-subsidized corporate form in order to use their private assets to affect the public is an especially interesting and potentially worrisome form of power.
Let's talk about think tanks per se. Is there such a thing as a truly nonpartisan think tank, or is it just too hard because of where the money's coming from?
Well, I'd say that you're more likely to make the case that there are nonpartisan universities, universities which are funded in not entirely dissimilar ways from think tanks. Well, officially, they have to be nonpartisan. So do think tanks, too. In other words, they can't declare themselves in favor of particular political candidates. But think tanks have become far more popular in the United States as a result of the polarization and inequality in the United States, so that the idea generation that happens in think tanks and the policy frameworks and proposals that get disseminated from think tanks flow from philanthropic interests with particular policy positions in mind.
Tell me what you know about Google's history of philanthropic or foundation or think tank giving, and especially the timeline, because I understand it's accelerated quite a bit recently.
Yeah. So Google, like lots of other tech firms, has gotten much more aggressive in its formal lobbying efforts. And I think it's now the case that the top five Silicon Valley companies are amongst the largest sources of lobbying, greater even than the five top Wall Street firms in New York. And there's been a parallel ramping up of the philanthropy that's associated with the tech firms. And that philanthropy comes in a variety of different forms.
So, Rob, knowing what you know about the situation with the New America Foundation and the Google money and the controversy, what would your advice be for them, for the New America Foundation?
The New America Foundation needs to be aware of the soft power, the agenda-setting influence that donors can have to the think tank, even in the absence of calling someone up and saying we disagree or we object to the work that someone does. So when Anne-Marie Slaughter, whose job is chiefly to ensure the existence of the New America Foundation into the future, which involves fundraising, does her work, she needs to be cautious that she hasn't internalized the policy preferences of the donors such that she shapes the work of the foundation around the donor interests. The idea is, you're worried about the conversation you'll have with your donor in the future, and so you orient the work that you do to please the donor rather than to displease the donor, and that has functionally the same outcome from the donor's perspective without even having to say anything.
Now, your own fine university, Stanford, benefited, was founded from the largesse, private largesse of a man, Leland Stanford, who, you know, most of history paints him as a classic robber baron, a railroad man who did all kinds of stuff that we would frown upon today. Talk to me about that and whether that's a conversation that takes place regularly at Stanford, or is it avoided?
So I'd say people here are aware of the history of the university and the deep connection between philanthropy and the well-being of especially wealthy universities. People here, I think, know something about the history of Leland Stanford. And so there is an effort on campus to unearth the sordid history of the university's initial benefactor.
Has there been any movement of any kind of magnitude to rename the university?
Not that I know of. They're starting with lower hanging fruit, other monuments and places on campus named for people with no obvious connection to the university and whose historical records are not so appealing.
So let's say I have some money, Rob, name your figure, and I want to set up a foundation, okay? Mm-hmm. And I come to you and I say, you know, I'm a big believer in bringing critics into the inner circle. And I know that you've been critical of how foundations behave and that it's undemocratic and so on. But you know, Rob, I'd like to make you the director of my foundation, the executive of my foundation. And let's say I made my money in ammonia fertilizer. How would you go about setting it up in a way that takes advantage of my largesse to try to accomplish something that we could all agree is some kind of public good without falling into all the traps that you've been describing to us?
So at first, I'd say, despite the fact that laws don't require me to be especially transparent about what the foundation is doing, I pledge to make completely available to the public all of the grant making we do, the evaluations of the grants that we make. I want to invite in outside experts as well. And I would want to find ways in which to organize a foundation's efforts to seek out the most severe critics of what we were doing in order to try to learn the most in order to give grants away to greater effect. And I'd like to see possibly experimentation with a form of foundation peer review in which, you know, an effort analogous to what happens in academia happens within the foundation world. It would be surprising if the philanthropic efforts of corporations were purely altruistic. Corporations seek to advance their own interests, especially in their lobbying, quite possibly often in their philanthropy. I'm trying to stimulate people to be morally awake and in the same moment to get people to consider what types of public policies or frameworks ought to govern and structure our collective lives, which is a moral and philosophical question.
That was the Stanford political scientist Robert Riche. We also heard from Anne-Marie Slaughter, Barry Lynn, and Franklin Foer. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, why do we choke under pressure? What's it feel like?
For me, it was terrifying.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Target, presenting Future at Heart, a new podcast that explores the work of changemakers across the country and highlights projects in cities like Miami, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Future at Heart, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to enable customers to bundle home and auto insurance. More information available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
If you are a big golf fan, and statistically speaking, you are almost certainly not. But if you are, you know that the Open Championship, or what Americans call the British Open, is the oldest and arguably most important major tournament in golf. This summer, it was won by Francesco Molinari, the first Italian to ever win a major. And it was held at the infamous Scottish course Carnoustie, which is so difficult, it's often called Carnastie. Carnoustie also hosted the Open back in 1999.
The golf course was so hard that it inevitably was going to give us some bizarre conclusion.
That's Brandel Chamblee. He played on the PGA Tour for 15 years. Now he's an analyst for the Golf Channel.
There was going to be a train wreck at some point.
And yet, on the tournament's final day, on the final hole, stood a man who had tamed this savage course.
The golfing gods are with the young man at this moment, and it'll be interesting to see what he does now.
This man, Jean Vandeveld, with one hole to play, held a three-stroke lead.
He would have been the first Frenchman in over 100 years to have won the Open Championship. And there was a sense that Frenchmen don't win majors. Frenchmen paint beautiful paintings and they write epic books about democracy and revenge. They don't win the Open Championship.
But standing on the final tee with a three-stroke lead, if you are a professional golfer, you will not lose that tournament. How ludicrous would that be? Imagine a professional chef. She's about to make an omelet. She goes to crack an egg on the side of the bowl, but instead, she somehow misses the bowl entirely and smashes the egg all over her face. That's how ludicrous it would be to lose a golf tournament standing on the last tee with a three-shot lead. It would require a grotesque combination of decisions and actions. There's a word for this. It is such a horrific word that some people don't even like to say it aloud. We're not one of those people.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways people can choke. And it doesn't have to be, you know, the Olympic Games. It can be when you're parallel parking and people around you are watching, right?
If we're going to talk about choking, we probably need to bring in some psychologists.
I'm Anders Ericsson, and I'm a professor of psychology at Florida State University here in Tallahassee, Florida.
Anders Ericsson, pioneer of the deliberate practice movement and the 10,000 hours idea, has been studying expert performers for years.
Ballet dancers, gymnasts, and all sorts of athletes. We've looked at chess experts, surgeons, doctors, teachers, musicians, taxi drivers, recreational activities like golf, and even there's some research on scientists.
Define choking for me as you see it.
Well, choking to me is actually somebody who cramps up and in some ways becomes unable to, you know, really act in appropriately in a situation or acts in a very decreased performance.
I've defined choking as worse performance than you'd expect from an individual, given that there is high pressure or stakes associated with the situation.
And that's Sion Bylock.
I'm a cognitive scientist, and I am president of Barnard College at Columbia University.
Before coming to Barnard, Bylock ran the Human Performance Lab at the University of Chicago. She also wrote a book called Choke. So I'm curious to know if you can sort of rank the different domains that people engage in regularly and where we're most likely to choke.
I really think that any situation where there's expectations for success can cause choking. And it doesn't have to be, you know, the Olympic Games. It can be when you're parallel parking and people around you are watching, right? Or if you're in an elevator and you're trying to figure out whether you're going to say something to the person next to you. You know, we talk about these epic moments of choking, but it's a desire to perform at our best, and situations in which we're evaluated happen constantly.
Give me a little bit on the characteristics of those who are more and less prone to choke. What about high IQ versus low IQ?
In my research and in others, we've shown, perhaps counterintuitively, that individuals who have the most ability to focus, the most working memory, the most fluid intelligence are actually more prone to perform poorly under stress. And the idea is that if you normally devote lots of cognitive resources to what you're doing, and being in a pressure-filled situation robs you of those resources, you can't perform as well.
You've just described all the reasons why I'm not very good at playing golf under pressure. And then let me just ask you one more kind of summary about surroundings. Talk about choking in a what you might call a friendly environment versus a hostile environment.
There's research showing that when you have friendly faces in front of you, people who are supportive, although that could feel nice, it actually creates pressure-filled situations. You often start thinking of yourself as they might. And so when my mother is in the room, I sometimes think of myself as a young girl. And you also are quite self-conscious.
In a recent episode about the World Cup, we looked at the research into why there's such a strong home field advantage in most sports. The most plausible explanation is that referees are subconsciously influenced by the home crowd and may make one or two key calls in the home team's favor. The research also showed that on balance, athletes themselves do not perform better in front of a home crowd. And in fact, when Sion Bylock tells us that friendly faces may actually create pressure-filled situations, you have to wonder if on some dimensions they might perform even worse.
My main research interests are behavioral economics, contest theory, and sports economics.
That's Alex Krumer. He's an economist at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland. He recently co-authored a paper called Choking Under Pressure in Front of a Supportive Audience, Evidence from Professional Biathlon. That is the sport combining cross-country skiing with precision rifle shooting.
Who's shooting quickly up there? Lesser. Wow, gone through quickly and goal.
Krumer analyzed the performance of more than 400 biathletes, male and female, over 15 years of competition, including world championships and the Olympics. How did they do at home versus abroad? Let's look first at the skiing portion.
So we find that home biathletes, they ski faster at home, about 2 seconds faster.
Okay, so maybe all those home cheers do spur the athletes to ski faster. How about the shooting?
Both men and women miss more shots when competing in their home country compared to competing abroad.
Men missed, on average, 0.15 more shots at home than abroad. Women, a bit more, 0.2 shots.
One may say that this is not too much, but it's quite a large effect if we take into account that the average time it takes to ski a penalty loop is about 25 seconds.
That's right. For every missed shot, you have to ski a small penalty loop.
So this means that when competing at home, a biathlete loses on average 4 to 6 seconds. And to put this number into perspective, in the Olympic Games in Sochi, the home biathlete Anton Chipulin, which, by the way, I love his performance. He was only 0.7 seconds away from a bronze medal after missing one shot.
But what if skiing faster is what causes you to miss more shots?
So one may assume that since they ski faster, they have higher heart rate, and therefore they miss more. But the evidence on the association between heart rate and shooting performance is mixed.
Okay, so that doesn't seem to explain the worst shooting at home. Is there maybe another explanation?
The second explanation is that usually they perform the shooting task in a very automatic manner. They don't look around, they don't care about anything. But probably when you perform at home, something disturbing you.
Krumer tells us that biathletes usually perform the shooting in a very automatic manner. That sounds like it might be relevant to our choking discussion. So what exactly does that mean? Back to the psychologist Sion Bailak.
We know that sometimes people don't perform up to their potential precisely when they want to the most. And sometimes that happens because people pay too much attention to the details of what they're doing, details that should be left on autopilot.
At the Human Performance Lab, Bailak and her colleagues did an experiment with expert golfers and novices.
So we set up a putting green in our lab, and when we tried to ask experts for their memories of how they'd taken a putt, they couldn't tell us so much about it. The novices, the people who were just learning, could tell us way more. And we thought, wow, this might be an indication that these high-level golfers aren't paying so much attention to what they're doing. And so one of the reasons that they might perform poorly under stress is when they start paying attention.
The way you've just put that would not be that surprising to anyone who follows, let's say, golf per se, right?
It is true that, sometimes athletes have these moments of feelings of being in the zone. But I think, we often don't think about this idea that paying too much attention could actually be counterproductive. Like you hear coaches yelling, concentrate all the time. And so being able to actually show that when you're at this high level, you're not paying attention to the details. And one of the reasons you mess up is because you start paying attention to those details allowed us to start asking questions about how we prevent you from paying attention to the details.
What is it that people actually are thinking about when they're doing putting?
Anders Ericsson also did putting experiments in his lab at Florida State with somewhat different results.
So we actually asked our participants to think out loud and recruited skilled and less skilled individuals. And what we found was that the skilled individuals, they were actually verbalizing more about thoughts and basically factors that they were taking into account in order to actually decide how they were going to putt the putt. So the argument is that if you're really skilled, you're actually generating now a rich description here of the situation. So you're trying to take into account here how basically the ball would roll and where you need to aim in order to have the appropriate ball path.
So I know that some psychologists argue that what separates the better performers, the top-tier performers from the rest of us, is, some form of automaticity, right? That you're going into some free-flowing state that's dependent on all your talent and experience, et cetera, but you're not actually engaging in it cognitively. You're saying that's not what you found.
What we're finding is that experts are able to make adjustments, when they're performing. So if you're a musician and the acoustics in a given performance environment is different, you can actually make adjustments in the same way that a soccer player, when the situation changes, they can actually make adjustments appropriate to that situation.
So let me ask you this, Anders. To what degree do you believe that choking is the factor or a main factor that actually separates an absolute top-tier performer from someone who's talented and so on, but doesn't reach the top tier? In other words, is the expert, is the professional, the very good performer who has learned to not choke?
My experience is that choking is quite rare by those individuals that we study who are consistently excelling. And it seems to be almost part of being an expert is that you deal with the kind of situations that would be, experiences very high pressure for other people.
So that's an interesting continuum. High pressure performances can lead to choking, but expert performers who compete under pressure all the time tend to not choke. Of course, it does happen.
For me, it was terrifying.
Jeremy Abbott was one of the best figure skaters in the world. He won the U.S. Men's Championship 4 times and went to the Olympics in 2010 and 2014. Things didn't go so well at the Olympics.
Opening with a quad toe right here. Oh, short of rotation, could not pull that landing together. hard fall there.
This is a disastrous performance.
It was unlike any other situation I'd ever been in. All of my practice and all of my preparation, once I got to the games, everything really kind of leading up to that moment at both Olympics in Vancouver and in Sochi, I was really excited. I could see the rings. And the moment I went out in Vancouver and in Sochi, every insecurity that I had about myself and about my skating was just magnified by a million. And I was just so focused on not wanting to make a mistake. I was in the wrong mindset.
Both times, Abbott failed to medal in the individual events. He retired from competitive skating in 2016, and he now coaches in Detroit. He uses his own experience to help the next generation.
I should have been focusing less on outcome and less on performance and more just on the process and getting my job done and accomplishing what I do every single day in training and really taking all of that experience and all of that work and putting it to use rather than focusing on what if that, what if this, you know, anything could happen. But whenever I skated my best, it was never focusing on a placement or a point total or pleasing somebody else. It was always just, okay, I'm here and I'm going to do a job. And that was when I always skated my best.
Yeah, it's precisely those times when you do start thinking too much that you can flub a performance.
Sion Bylock again.
And so any situation that causes you to attend in ways that you might not normally can mess you up.
So can I just say, I love our species. I think we're kind of awesome. I mean, we have some flaws and so on. But doesn't it seem like a weird counterbalance that we tend to choke most in the circumstances, as you've been telling us, that matter the most to us? Doesn't that just seem like a design flaw?
It is interesting. I mean, I guess you could say that maybe we haven't adapted to those situations yet. I mean, we've certainly been in social situations for a long time, but our level of self-consciousness and metacognitive ability, the ability to know what we and others are thinking, is something that's probably fairly recent, evolutionarily wise.
So we should probably take a look at how we think differently and perform differently as the stakes rise.
That would have made me very nervous.
That's coming up right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Target, presenting Future at Heart, a podcast on changemakers and the projects they're championing in communities nationwide. Future at Heart, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting progress in education, science, and the arts. Information at cysimsfoundation.org.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
When psychologists think about choking under pressure, they consider a variety of thought processes that may be subtle and hard to measure. Economists look at choking a bit differently.
Say that you would have paid me $1 million if I'll give the best interview of the week.
Uri Ghanizi is an economist at the University of California, San Diego.
That would have made me very nervous. That would have made me put more effort into this. When we look at incentives in economics, we think about two ways in which it's going to affect us. The first is that if I'll pay you more, you'll put more effort in the task. And the second assumption is that more effort will lead to better performance. And that's not necessarily true, and that's the part of choking. It might be that I can push you so much to try so hard that it will actually backfire and you'll perform worse.
Ghanizi co-authored one of the foundational economics papers on choking. It's called Large Stakes and Big Mistakes. He and his colleagues ran experiments in a variety of places, including India.
The reason we wanted to go to India is that over there, our money can go a long way. So we went to some villages in India in which the daily wage was so low that we could offer them up to 6 months of salary in our experiment if they did perfectly well.
Each participant completed a series of tasks. Some were creative.
So the creative one was, for example, to pack pieces of metal into a box in an efficient way.
Some tasks were cognitive.
A memory game in which I would read up numbers and you listen to me, and then at some point I'll say stop, and then you'll have to recall the last three numbers that I mentioned.
And some tasks were athletic.
Throwing dart-like balls, so balls on a target, and things like that.
The payout for successful completion of the task was variable. In some cases, you'd get 10 cents. In others, a dollar. And in others, $10.
And $10 was about what they made in a month over there. I hope that you agree with me that 6 months of pay is a lot of money that would make you work much harder, right? And the question was, are you going to be better, actually, when you work harder?
As Ghanizi noted earlier, it's a standard assumption in labor economics that higher pay leads to more effort, and that more effort leads to better performance, or at least higher productivity. What happened in this case when the stakes were raised all the way to $10?
So the findings were striking. You see reduction in success rates across the board. All six games that we played resulted in lower success rate when the incentives were really high.
For the three-digit memory game, roughly 40% of the participants succeeded under low incentives. Under high incentives, the success rate was just 20%. For the dartball game, the success rate under low incentives was 10% and around 7% under high incentives. For the metal packing game, under low incentives, 25% of the participants succeeded. Under high incentives, nobody succeeded. Or, put another way, at least 25% of them choked.
Actually, we were a bit surprised by this experiment because we included tasks in which we expected that effort will increase performance.
But if you think about it, you can see why the researchers maybe shouldn't have been so surprised. In these experiments, increased effort isn't simply a matter of putting in more time, the way you might with an assignment at work or a project at school. It was trying to execute the same task with and without pressure. So, Ghanizi and his colleagues wanted to learn more about what sort of tasks make us succumb to pressure. They ran some more experiments at MIT using students as their research subjects. Some experiments involved simple manual tasks like punching alternating keyboard keys as fast as possible.
It's really something that, you know, if you do it for long enough, it's boring. So if I'll pay you more, you'll try maybe harder. And we believe that more effort will actually increase your performance.
Other tasks were more cognitive, like adding numbers and matrices.
When you think about cognitive tasks, you probably reach your optimal behavior, your best, very fast. And now if I'm really, really making it high incentives, you might actually start being, you know, distracted.
Once again, there were low and high incentive versions of each task. Since a dollar doesn't go as far in Massachusetts as it does in India, the rewards here were up to $30 for the low incentive experiments and up to $300 for the high.
So what we found is that for the key pressing task, when you increase the incentives from up to $30 to up to $300, they switch from about 40% succeeding to 80% succeeding. On the other end, when you have to add up numbers, the more cognitive one, we see a sharp decrease from 65% to 40%. So when you actually have to put some cognitive effort into this, getting the incentives to be ridiculously high could actually be a bad idea.
This would seem to be pretty good evidence that when activities involve some thinking, we're more susceptible to choking. Or, as you've probably heard from a lot of people over the years, coaches and teachers and counselors of all sorts, you are capable of doing some amazing things if you can only get your brain out of the way. But that's obviously harder than it sounds. So how can you do that? How can you prepare yourself to not crumble under the very circumstances that matter most?
How do we get people to focus on aspects of their performance that are going to be beneficial for success, especially in those situations that are most problematic?
Sion Bylock again, going back to her golf experiments.
So we investigated whether going quicker, for example, might help eliminate poor performance under pressure, or having one key swing thought that encapsulates your entire stroke might be better. And we showed that some of that was successful. And it leads to the opposite idea that if you really want to mess your buddy up on the back nine, you just say, hey, that was a great shot. What were you doing with your elbow?
All right, great. So you're helping us make people choke more, but what else can you tell us about, in this domain at least, learning to choke less?
We also showed that getting used to this type of hyper attention to detail that sometimes comes with performance can be helpful. So really inoculating yourself against the high pressure situations. You see this with students who practice taking time tests. You see this with military pilots and firefighters and people who practice under some of the types of conditions they're going to perform under. And you even see this if you walk by a college football stadium Friday afternoon, the music blaring, getting the players used to what it's going to feel like to be in that big stadium. And this is true in really big, important situations, but it's also true in those little things we do every day. So if you're going to give a toast at a wedding, practicing doing it while people are watching you. And if no one is willing to watch you, videotape yourself. Anything that gets you used to the kinds of all eyes on you.
Okay, so put yourself in realistic and stressful practice situations. What else?
Rethinking how you're feeling. So we know that when people remind themselves that that sweaty palms and beating heart aren't a sign they're going to fail, but a sign that they're awake and ready to go and that their body is shunting important nutrients to their mind, that can be really effective.
Now, is that a charade or is that real? I mean, if my palms are sweaty, isn't that an indication that I am anxious and that if I just tell myself, well, it's not really anxiety, it's really my body shunting nutrients. I mean, is that a self-lie that I profit from, or is that realistically, you know, a counter-truth?
First of all, I will just say that I like placebo effects, and you know, I have no right. problem with that. But I think it's a real truth because, you know, if your heart wasn't beating to some extent, you'd be dead, right? And those sweaty palms can be an indication that you're alert and aroused and ready to go. And arousal doesn't have to be a bad thing, right? It's bad when we start thinking it's bad, and then we start changing our performance.
What about other means of directing the mind, whether meditation, perhaps?
Yeah, so there's lots of research showing that meditative practices can help change how you focus and your ability to focus on what you want and get rid of what you don't. That's true with visualizing positive performance outcomes ahead of time. And really, you know, focusing on why you should succeed, right? What are the factors that you've practiced well? You've got this. You've had situations like this in the past, and they've gone really well.
But then there are situations that you haven't had in the past, situations that are way bigger, way more pressurized than anything you could have prepared for.
On the eve of that championship, Jean Vandevelde was ranked 152nd in the world, and people that are 152nd in the world don't win major championships.
Brandel Chambly again, talking about the unlikely but apparently inevitable British Open victory of Jean Vandevelde.
The golfing gods are with him. Some golfing god is with the young man at this moment, and it'll be interesting again to see what he does now.
All he had to do was score a double bogey six or better on the par four 18th hole at Carnoustie.
But it was a devastatingly hard hole, no question about it. There was OB to the left, a burn down the right, a bunker sort of out there to the right.
OB is out of bounds. A burn is a Scottish term for a creek. Rather than playing his tee shot safe with an iron, Vandevelde stuck with what he'd done all week, and he hit driver.
Uh-oh.
He pushed his drive way, way right.
Oh, you lucky little rascal. He's pushed that away and missed the water. He's almost, well, he's right in front of the 17th tee.
So now he pulls a 2-iron out. So he's going to be safe going to the right.
Well,
I don't believe this.
Well, hello, what is going on here?
So it hits the stands, really hit a pole. Then it's going to go in the burn.
Let's have a look where he is. He's still short of the burn. I think, really, if anybody needs an advisor, he does at this moment.
But it doesn't go in the burn. It hits the bricks, the rocks, and it bounces over the burn.
great break.
Lying just two in the hay, right? So not so bad.
Just two, and he's 30 yards away. 30 yards away. So two great breaks. He goes down there and there with renewed hope. All he's got to do is get this wedge out. But again, this is where I would imagine the real choking started, because now then he's in a really difficult situation. And that's where he hit a shot that was really just hard to describe. I mean, it's like he stopped swinging halfway down.
What are you doing? What on earth are you doing? No, Jean, please. Would somebody kindly go and stop him? Give him a large brandy and mop him down.
And the ball went right in the burn. And then it became surreal. And he thinks he can play it.
He's gone gaga because this is quite... I've never seen anything like it before, and to attempt to hit the ball out of there is pure madness.
So here he is, pants up, and he decides he can't play it. So now he gets to go back and drop it.
First good decision he's made on the hole, maybe.
That's right, but the lie forced him to make a good decision. And here's how you get disastrous. It's never just one thing. It's always a confluence of two or three or four things that were almost unprecedented. So now he drops the ball, taking the penalty shot. So he's three in, four out, hitting five. Five is in the bunker.
Hasn't hit it hard enough. They played a similar shot to the one he plopped into the burn.
Now he's got an easy bunker shot. Bunker shots are not difficult for professional golfers. He gets it out to 6 feet. Now here's the thing to remember, is that he makes that putt.
And then he looks around like, why is everybody not cheering crazy?
That's right.
For me?
That's right.
His golfing brain stopped about 10 minutes ago, I think.
But Vandeveld hadn't won. He made a triple bogey 7, which put him in a three-man playoff for the Open Championship. He lost the playoff to Paul Laurie. Jean Vandeveld never did win a major championship. We called up Vandeveld ourselves recently to check in with him.
Yes, Stephen, I can hear you. Hello.
Unfortunately, the connection was very poor, so the tape isn't really worth playing. We'll post the transcript on freakonomics.com so you can read it there if you'd like. Anyway, we had a nice chat about his family, his continuing involvement with golf. Vandeveld was instrumental in bringing the Ryder Cup to France this fall. And, of course, that terrible 18th hole at Carnoustie in 1999. I asked if it was difficult to talk about it. It's never been difficult, he said. Just after not winning the Open, it was painful, but you're a professional athlete. I asked what it felt like standing on the 72nd tee with a 3-shot lead. I stood there pretty confident, to be honest, he said. I wasn't overly emotional or emotional at all. My nerves were holding pretty okay. I asked Vandeveld if during the long and difficult adventure on the 18th hole, he had indeed lost track of his score and the lead. Definitely not, he said. Lying 5 in the bunker, he told me, I knew I needed to hole it to win the tournament. And then I asked him this. You became famous for not having won the Open. Your 72nd hole has been called the worst choke in golfing history. Do you think that's true or fair? And he said,
I think we need to ask the definition of choke.
I think we need to ask the definition of choke. I think I had 2 days to choke, he said. So a choke? You know, I wouldn't call that a choke, without a doubt. I would probably use a different word, but certainly not that one. Earlier, I'd asked Brandel Chamblee how Vandeveld had handled the meltdown.
I mean, his remarks afterwards were as measured and respectful and appropriate and magnanimous as anybody I've ever heard that had gone through something so traumatic. And I gained a great deal of respect for him immediately.
A lot of other people gained respect for him, too. When I asked Vandeveld himself how that one hole changed his life, he said, you know, it's very easy to win with grace. It's a lot harder to lose with it. And without patronizing anybody or blowing my own trumpet, I would say that the way that I see life and the way that I've accepted what happened, I believe that's what people like. It's in my nature to see it the way that I see it, and that's the end of that.
It's in my nature to see it the way that I see it, and that's the end of that.
I wish Jean Vandevelde were still playing competitive golf, only so I could root for him to win every week. I agree that losing with grace is not easy, and I agree he accomplished that. And as Brandel Chambly points out, the loss did come with some consolation points.
Think about this now. You know, that adage that nobody remembers who finished second? Well, in this particular instance, hardly anybody remembers who won.
Remember, go to Freakonomics.com if you'd like to read the transcript of the Jean Vandevelde interview. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week, but if you just don't want to wait, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio archive at Freakonomics.com or at Stitcher, where you can also subscribe, or on any podcast app. Thanks again.